Welcome to episode 275 of Five and Dive. It is Thursday, April 6th. I am your host, Craig Goldstein, editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus. Join me as my co-host today, Patrick Dubuque, author and editor at Baseball Prospectus. All I'm going to tell everyone on that one is no hesitation, but take two. So, Patrick, how are you doing today?
It's funny, you said Thursday, right? Or was that the first take?
I said Thursday both. It is okay, Thursday, good. Right?
Yeah. Thank God. My kids are on spring break, so it's not Thursday for me.
Okay.
It is, muffled sound day. and tomorrow will continue to be that day. Time has lost any mooring for me. I'm going to go watch the Mario movie in IMAX later on.
Oh, well, I'm sorry about that. I hope it's better than it looks, is what I will say.
I hope it looks better than it is, because I don't think it's good, and hopefully it looks okay. I haven't been to a movie in a theater in 4 years.
Yeah, is that exciting for you?
To
even do this?
Well, no.
Just to...
Okay. But I need to not exist for 90 minutes, and then make time move forward. So hopefully that accomplishes that goal. I'm not somebody who's heavily invested in Mario culture or plotting.
I'm not like super invested, but I don't think it's good that they keep advertising the movie. They advertise it heavily while showing basically as little as possible. Barely get Chris Pratt's American. Well, yeah,
they clearly are trying to avoid having Chris Pratt speak in the commercials.
Well, that seems like bad for the movie where he's the main character.
I mean, it is clearly damage mitigation, right? My main concern is that I'm going to spend 90 minutes in a row going, wow, that's Chris Pratt. Whoa, still Chris Pratt. Wow. and that's, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what's going to happen. It's me having to deal with that constantly. We'll see. Anyway, baseball exists, I'm told.
Baseball does exist. That is, that's like almost a podcast name for some DraftKings or something or other podcast. But yes, baseball exists and we're here to talk about it. Shall we go into our first topic, Patrick?
Let's.
Okay. Item number one here. Red bird, red ass. I am guessing since it's been spring break and you have lost all sense of time, you might not be super up on what's happening in St. Louis. Are you aware of the situation there at this point?
So I have read about it. I don't know if I understand it. If there's a backstory to this, I feel like this is the third episode of a show and I missed the first two episodes because this can't all just have happened yesterday. Right. There has to have been some sort of like,
well, the news kind of, I think it happened the day before.
There had to be some spring feud or some sort of like,
well, passive aggressive. Ollie Marmol is getting into feuds for sure. He had a whole little tiff with CB Buckner, I think. Before a spring training game, Buckner refused to shake his hand after an incident the year before. So Ollie is getting into some stuff. It's not all him. I that seems a lot more like Buckner's issue, to be fair to Marmol. But this seems like a clubhouse kind of issue, but it's very odd to me that this is all playing out in the media. I mean, credit to the reporters covering this situation and pursuing it, but it seems very odd to me that Marmol is discussing it publicly at all.
Yeah, so let's tell everybody what actually happened.
Okay, so for those unfamiliar, Tyler O'Neill was thrown out at home plate by a pretty significant margin.
I think that's understating it. He was thrown out in like the most embarrassing way. Like he managed, like in the tag, he almost kind of got suplexed. It was pretty good. Like he just got stopped with his leg in the air. It looked brutal.
And I guess Marmol's position on this is that he was not running hard enough. So he said something to the degree of like how he took the turn. He didn't like, I guess it was too wide a turn.
I thought it was too sharp and he slowed himself down by not rounding enough. Maybe it was the other way.
Did you watch you watched the video. Did you get the sense that Tyler O'Neill was not hustling?
So when I watched the video, I think there's one damning moment in it where after the highlight I saw, you did not see O'Neill's true path, and I didn't see how he ran at the corner. But as he's coming home, and it's a sharply hit ball shallow right to a guy who has a good arm, and I think that if it had been anybody else, nobody would have thought twice about it. But it's Tyler O'Neill. He's like literally one of the fastest guys in baseball, or he used to be.
He is one of the fastest. Last year, based on sprint speed, he was the fastest Cardinal.
Right.
29 point something feet per second. That's almost elite.
Yeah. He's not the fastest man in baseball this year. And like all year, he has not been sprinting as well, according to the metrics. But
he's made entirely, he's like a snake. He's made entirely of muscle.
Yeah. So he, as he's running home, there is a flash, like a little epiphany that you can see him having when he's halfway there. And he makes this little hitch.
There's like a little burst.
And there's, yeah. And it's like, oh no. And you can tell he figured out too late he needed to throw it to fifth gear. And if he hadn't done that, he might have gotten away with it. But he just showed enough of the fact that he could have been running faster that it made it real obvious when he got nailed to the plate that he probably could have been running a little faster. And, you know, the metrics, they did, of course, provide the sprint speed on that run. And they say that it was 28 feet per second.
That's pretty good.
Good. It's not Tyler.
But it's also, they only measure the fastest
right, of course,
second.
You know,
so, they probably caught that little burst.
Maybe. That's very possible. He, you know, 28 is still well below his usual average. Like, that's not elite the way that Tyler O'Neill should be elite. But it's good. It's just not great. And so, yeah.
I would say mitigating factor on O'Neill's part here is I don't think busting it, like if he was in fifth gear the whole way, I don't think he's safe at home.
You don't think so? I think he probably is.
Okay.
But the problem is that there's also the conditions where he didn't think he'd get sent, and the field was a little wet, and they were down three, and his run didn't really matter. And while, you know, Marmol commented that he basically said it's not his job to think about it, there's a third base coach, and he's correct. He's still, like, the fact that it was a little bit of a surprise that he got
Well, he did. So the second baseman also leaps for this ball. It's not clear to me how close that was, but I guess he took off on contact anyway, so yeah. It doesn't really matter.
Do I think that O'Neill should have been safe? Probably. Do I think that we should be talking about it now on this podcast?
Okay,
probably
so not. Right, we normally wouldn't. Other than that, Marmol benched O'Neill, which is it's fine, whatever. It's his prerogative. I recall Matt Williams benching Bryce Harper for not legging out, you know, a ground ball or whatever.
Well, and managers Marmol actually, do this. Sorry, Marmol actually did this last year too with Harrison Bader.
Yeah.
So there is precedent here.
Yeah, and he, you know, it's the surprise to me is kind of the degree to which Marmol is airing the dirty laundry, right? Like, so he can say, look, it's an internal issue. I've talked to Tyler about it. Like, we're moving forward, right? Which doesn't mean Tyler agreed, because we should be clear, Tyler does not agree.
No, he does not.
But, you know, O'Neill said that he's apparently said he was trying to stay healthy and on the field, which he was not last year. He hurt himself last year. He said, Marmol said, everyone wants to stay healthy, listed a bunch of names, and then said, like, that doesn't compute to me.
I am sympathetic towards O'Neill in this case, because I don't really understand what Marmol's trying to accomplish. He does have five outfielders, and you could just bench him and not, you know. But then... Yeah.
Well, and you can just say... I'm gonna read O'Neill's quote to the media. He said, obviously he thinks that I should have handled my play a little differently, but I'm a hard-nosed player. I got to the big leagues playing my ass off, and that's who I am. It's not something that should be decharacterized for me. I don't think it should have been handled that way. I think if there's internal issues, they should be handled internally. We should have each other's backs out there. Sometimes it doesn't go that way, I guess. Live and you learn. He was asked whether, how the two sides could move past this issue. And O'Neill said, I don't know. Continue with our communication, but really? I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's not up to him. Like, if he's going to get blasted next time he makes a mistake in the media, like, O'Neill doesn't really have anything he can do about that. What is he supposed to do? Like,
well, I mean, I guess the thing is, like, this, again, as you said, they have five outfielders. Lars Nootbaar is hurt right now, so maybe it's four. This feels like, I mean, this whole situation reeked of a trade when they brought Jordan Walker, you know, to St. Louis from spring training. It only reeks more of a trade to me right now. Like, but like, blasting the guy, I guess, I don't know if he's on his
way.
Well,
we just know which outfielder is getting traded now.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was, yeah, I guess it was him or Carlson potentially, yeah. But like, it felt like O'Neill the whole time. I don't know. The whole thing feels very weird. I don't think he's above criticism, right? Like, I think, like you said, you can kind of see that extra little burst. He runs a little harder. If Marmol, this is a thing for him, as you noted, he did this last year.
And then traded
Bader. And Bader got traded. I would note. But it does, I don't know. It just feels very weird and in a just a very public way.
I don't understand the thought process for Marmol. I don't understand how this benefits him or the team to do it this way. Are you sending a warning to your own players? Because you could probably still do that through, you know, the official channels. Is it that you're trying to, you know, it seems a little early to be so defensive as to, you know, try to brush off your own problems with a 2-4 team that can't pitch. By distracting it, by blaming it all on this guy. Like, I don't know. I don't see the end game for this that benefits.
It does feel a little too early in the season to be this cranky about anything.
Yeah. That's the other part. It's like game four, and I understand that they haven't been great, but it's not like the offense that has been the problem. I did, since you mentioned the pitching staff, I wanted to mention Drew Silva on Twitter. He said, maybe the Cardinals front office should have showed a little more hustle in building a pitching staff.
Steven Matz is your number two right now.
So Patrick, I don't think you have this on hand. I don't know if you can pull it together quickly, but you know, we did our position or like our team by team breakdown in the preseason with like our projected warp by position. Do you have like what the worst left fielder like would you be able to pull that? I'm just interested, like, where Tyler O'Neill fits on a number of teams, like the Rangers,
right. The Rangers are clear,
but like, can they trade for, like, do they have anything to trade for him? I don't want to go too deep on it, but I'm just kind of curious. Like, this doesn't seem like it's going to resolve itself well. It might take till the trade deadline, right? Like, the Cardinals might not be eager to just move on immediately, but I'm kind of interested in, like, where he might end up.
So, for the contending clubs, basically, right now, it seems like the best fits are, you got the Yankees, who, you know,
yeah, the Yankees wide open spot.
Yeah, Aaron absolutely. Hicks should not be. I don't know why the Yankees don't want Aaron Hicks to start, and yet they seem to do it to themselves anyway. they just refuse. The Mariners also, you know.
Bring him home.
Yeah, it'd be ironic, but yes. They could trade him back for Marco.
Marco Gonzalez, exactly.
And then depending on how you feel about David Peralta, the Dodgers. Probably. And you've got the Braves.
Right, Braves might be the best option. It's maybe too bad that, I mean, they're using all their pitchers right now.
Jared Schuster is very Cardinals, but they don't need another one. The problem is,
well, and Ian Anderson,
all the Cardinals
fully
pitchers
broken.
Are very Cardinals. Yes,
Bryce Elder, Dylan Dodd, and Jared Schuster are in the majors.
Yes,
so like you start running out of guys that kind of make sense for the Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
On that respect.
Rangers for Owen White. That's my official prediction.
Okay. All right. Yeah. The Rangers have arms. It's just like, which ones do you like?
Yeah.
Kind of like, and how much do you like them? The Yankees, Yoni Brito came out of nowhere, looked pretty good. I don't know. They kind of need him, right? Like I think we talked about this. They traded all the Wesneskis and the Waldichuks and Sears and those guys. And you're, I mean, Yoni Brito again looked good, but you kind of need him. Luis Gil is hurt. You know, it's you need the backup guys because they're working with a 4-man rotation right now after sending Brito down. So, yeah, I don't know.
And one other team, and this could transition to our next point, possibly the Rays. I mean, you have Manny Margot. And right, and
so Margot, it's, you know, it's tough because they like the guys that they have.
Yeah,
the question is, like, do you squeeze out, I'm sorry, Jeffrey, do you squeeze out Jose Siri?
We'll get to Jose Siri. I don't know what I don't like predicting what the Rays are going to do. Like, this is kind of a Rays trade because he's got some pop,
he fits,
he's
them.
Platoonable. He really is. Yeah,
he's a distressed asset.
He's really good defensively in a corner. Yeah. He can spot in center, but he can really play a corner.
Who are they even? I mean, they're playing Syrian center. Who are they
Luke
playing?
Raley is getting some
Luke
run.
Luke Raley,
right now.
Man.
He's hitting.
Raley is actually more raised than Tyler O'Neill. So he's 28. I mean, they both might be 28, but.
Yeah, and you've also got Josh Lowe. And
Josh Lowe, who was also
off to a decent start. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also you got Harold Ramirez at DH, which
all right. Well, let's talk about our second topic, which is it's going to be just you and me today waiting for the other shoe to drop in Tampa Bay. And the Rays are undefeated. As we talk about all these guys who are hitting, Luke Raley is hitting, Josh Lowe is hitting, Jose Siri is hitting, Randy Arozarena has never stopped hitting, to my chagrin. And this team is performing very well. I would argue it's even pitching better than it is hitting. I will caveat all of this with that they have played arguably two of the three worst teams in the majors. They have played the Nationals and they have played the Tigers. They have yet to play the A's, who I would throw in there as potentially the worst or one of the worst teams in the majors.
A's aren't even the worst team in their own division right now. So, I don't know.
Didn't take long for a Seattle dig to pop up. So, I guess, Patrick, what are you buying? I don't think we have to buy whether the Rays are, you know, the Rays are 6-0, and I think they've earned it. They've played some very bad teams. They've played very well. How much of it is real to you?
Nothing's real. I mean, this is the curse of April. This is why... You know, opening day is great. Everyone loves opening day. And then we have this next 3 or 4 weeks where you can't really actually believe anything. And we still do. And we're wrong to do it. And we all just kind of agree that we're all going to be wrong together in caring about this stuff. It's six games. You can't pull anything meaningful out of six games, especially against the Tigers and the Nationals. But, like... I don't know. It's the team looks good. I mean, we thought it looked good before the season started. The holes in the team are the same holes that we expected there to be. You know, Francisco Mejia is their starting catcher, and
he has one hit.
Yeah, he has one hit, and he doesn't play defense particularly well.
Also, one more than Christian Bethencourt. So
that is true.
True.
And Mike Zunino. It's not like Zunino has been doing too well.
So we did this for the Orioles on Monday. Do you know how many Rays players have an OPS?
So I will not.
OPS over 1,000. You're both looking at their page right now, aren't you?
Yeah.
All right. It's six to answer the question.
And they've got three guys under 330. So that's this is where we are in April. The numbers are just, they're not real numbers.
They are. I do think, look, what we have not mentioned Wander Franco, one of the guys OPSing over 1,000. 417, 481, 792 is his slash line. He struck out two times. He's largely underwhelmed in his career thus far. He's been good, but underwhelmed relative to, I think, expectations.
He's 22.
Yeah, exactly.
He just turned 22.
I said to this point.
I mean, he's been hurt. He's been hurt more than anything else, I feel like.
He has. And he's been fine. I wasn't saying he's been bad. I was saying underwhelmed to this point. Some of that is due to missing time, certainly.
Yeah. Yes, he is. By BRF, he has...
Well, like five,
four. 6.5 WAR in 159 games. But yes.
Well,
I mean, I'm fair enough. Saying, if you think he's an elite player, then yes, he has underwhelmed a little bit, I guess.
Well, I think he was expected to be elite, and people argued almost immediately. I think especially with the
343, 452 is his career line in the majors. Like, look, if he just does that, I mean, he's going to feel disappointing, but if he just does that, he's going to make all-star games. And...
yeah, I mean, sure. Some of that, his career slugging line, to the point that he hasn't played that much,
yeah,
has moved 13 points in six 2023 sure games.
Yeah.
You know, so, I know we had last year's crop of rookies. I still think we're suffering from a unreasonable level of expectations about rookies and rookie progression based on the last, I don't know, it feels like the last 5 years
we've had. Yeah, I wrote a piece about how rookies were hitting the ground running in a way we hadn't seen, and that was, I don't know, probably five years ago at this point. But I think that was true about a lot of guys at the time, whereas, like, you know, Franco was universally the number one overall prospect, and I think argued at the time extremely polished. I don't think the expectation for him to come in and hit the ground running in a little bit more of an impact is necessarily. I mean, look, I don't mean to slag 6 wins in a full season, but I think the expectation was maybe that it was going to be a little bit more, at least with the bat. I don't know. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe it's
we just assume every rookie to get better the year after they're a rookie, and we've forgotten about sophomore slumps, and we just don't see them as much, so we don't expect it anymore. And even this isn't even a sophomore slump by, you know, like sophomore slump standards. It's just literally getting hurt and not, you know.
Yeah, and some of it is the offensive environment. I mean, I think you look at 277, 328, 417 last year, and it doesn't feel like 17% better than league average.
I also think that some of the media frenzy just moved on to other newer rookies, right? You know, Drutchman and Rodriguez, and you know, sure. When they have their sophomore slumps, which not that they will, but you know, the attention will move on.
Sure. So the Rays, okay, Wander Franco aside, I'm sorry. Like, they are also seeing, you know, Manuel Margot has not been good. Harold Ramirez has not been good. What, you're laughing at
13 plate appearances. He's had three games.
I understand, but my point, I guess it's a statement of fact.
No, Patrick. It is. That's how April gets here. You just
do you
read
want
the
me
stats
to say that 167 is
no, we didn't.
Something
and we
other
didn't
than...
project Margot to be very good either, and we didn't project Ramirez to be very good. Like, they are performing about how we expected. They've just done it over, you know, three games worth of plate appearances.
Okay.
They're what they are.
I guess, so do you change anything about your expectations for the team? I will say Pecota's projected standings has moved them ahead of Toronto.
I mean, I picked them to win the AL East, personally.
Okay. So, no. So you predicted this. Okay.
I don't know if I predicted 6-0. But, I mean, and I don't know if I predicted Luke Raley to have a 1.375-year OPS. It's just, you know, they have depth, and the depth has worked, and you know, they have depth everywhere but catcher, and so it's not surprising to me that they're certainly one of those teams that is capable of putting together a week like this, right? Are they capable of putting together 2 weeks like this? I don't know. I think that the offense was bad last year, and I think that, you know, with situations like Franco being hurt, with a couple of guys. There was upside there with Arozarena, you know, kind of not having the season that everybody thought he was capable of.
If Brandon Lau starts striking out too much, which Brandon Lau can do, they have Curtis Meade, they have Oslevis Basabe, they have guys they want to fill the DH role if Harold Ramirez doesn't hit. They have Kyle Manzardo. Like, they just have, they have actually a fair amount of upper minors hitting depth to backfill here too.
Yeah,
they're both kind of still hilarious. Like, I only know who like half these guys are.
And they're one of the best bullpen. I think they are projected to be the best bullpen in the league.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I don't know who Kevin Kelly is.
I don't know who Kevin
Kelly is. Well, you don't need to know who Kevin Kelly is because next year it'll be awful.
I was going to note that their bullpen has surrendered 4 total runs this season.
Yeah.
Which is pretty. Oh, I'm sorry. Five total runs this season. One of them unearned for Garrett Clevenger. Yeah. I don't know. This is a good team. I'm still skeptical on the offense. I do find it compelling to Jeffrey's point that they have options. I know Luke Raley overhauled his swing. I'm going to be skeptical on that until it's happening against rotations that aren't the Tigers and the Nationals. But that aside, like if he's DHing for them or, you know, whatever, like to Jeffrey's point, they can turn to Manzardo, who I do think is pretty good, and they have options beyond that. And look,
for all these wild outcomes offensively so far, at least Isak Paredes is exactly Isak Paredes.
Yeah. Somebody knows how to be normal. I mean, Jose Siri is a great example of this. Like, is he going to be good? I mean, could be.
Don't ask Jeffrey that.
But, I mean, you know, he's also, he's got struck out.
Strikeouts in 20 played. Yeah. It's he's having the good Jose Siri week, basically.
Right, exactly.
Get a couple home runs, yeah.
All right. Our third topic, the better version of himself. Speaking of better versions, Grayson Rodriguez debuted. Jeffrey and I did a playback on this. We watched a lot of this game. I'm guessing Patrick did not get to watch a lot of this game.
I watched a lot of, well, I didn't watch a lot of highlights. I watched some highlights.
what was your thought? Was this a guy who deserved to have been sent down?
Well, you know, when you got guys like Daniel Kremer out there, Dean Kramer. Sorry, he's not even worth remembering his first name. It's you know, it's just a tough rotation to crack. It is very funny. It's funny how when a mistake like this gets made, or not a mistake, but because this is clearly very intentional, when something like this happens, nature immediately corrects itself and injure somebody so that he can pitch anyway.
It took two people, to be fair.
Yeah, exactly. It took whatever it took. It was going to happen.
And it is now, great after, course, like, Mike Elias just had to slag him off in the press, too. Like, he didn't have to do that. Then you can just call him back up, and it's like, all right, wait.
It would have been
a little extra mustard on it.
Yeah, it would have been perfectly reasonable. Like, it would have been so much easier for Elias to just say, hey, we wanted to keep his innings down because he got hurt last year. Literally, you could have done it in 5 seconds instead of saying, no, he's not quite Orioles rotation material.
I mean, look, I think you get into trouble if you say, like, we're trying to limit his innings because you spent all off season saying we expect him to break camp with the team.
Well, yeah, there's your first mistake. He just showed his cards. He should have known what future Mike Elias was going to say, right?
I know I said this at the time, but like, I don't understand. There was no downside to just saying we're going to slot him into the fifth spot in the rotation. He's going to go against other teams' bad guys. Like, even if he's not like the version they expected of him or whatever, the best version of himself or whatever the quote was, just say, you know, we're going to put him in there. There's zero pressure. You know, he gets to work with our coaches in the meantime, whatever. Jeff, he looked fine. That looked like a really successful major league debut to me. He was off on the first.
Yeah, he took an inning to settle in with some of the fans, get the feel for the breaking.
He's pitching
ball,
in his home state.
They flew him out there the night before on what I assume was fairly short notice from Norfolk
against
or wherever
Jacob
Norfolk
DeGrom
is.
For his major league debut, and he's got a ton of people there because he's from Nacogdoches, Texas. And of course it takes him an inning to settle in. And he's getting advice from his manager, like, pretend you're back in high school.
Yeah.
That was the real advice. And someone said, do you think that'll help? And the manager said, no.
I'm guessing
that was jovial and it wasn't that, but like, still.
My favorite part of the highlight that I watched is his father. It was obviously in the stands.
His father was sweating.
I've never identified with somebody more. Like, when my kid is like at a recital or something, I'm like in the back being like, just don't fuck this up, okay? Please don't. you know, afterwards when I have to talk to her, I'll be like, God, that was great, honey. You did wonderful. I support it. At the time, I'm like, I felt like this man. Like, there's two shots.
He was doing like the two palms in his eyes. Yep. Like, just, oh my God.
Yeah, he was rubbing
like, runs had come in, and he's like, oh, kill me.
I want to, you know, it, like, you know, this is, he's allowed to have this. He can go after the game and then, you know, support his son. The time is just like, let him be racked with anxiety.
You're looking for some support in the
I look over at dad.
And he's like, oh, Christ.
going to match of the game, like, Josh Jung, really?
The guy doesn't make contact of anything, you know, but he looked good after the first inning. I said this during the playback, but I honestly felt a little bit like he was watching DeGrom and going like, oh, I'm going to try and do that. Like, he obviously he's not going to throw 101 on the black or whatever, but the first inning he's catching a lot of the plate or missing entirely. And all of a sudden he starts lining up, spotting his fastball on the corner. He didn't ever really get the secondaries fully in line, but he was able to use the fastball command to get guys to chase the breaking ball, you know, when he wanted to, later in the game.
I think my favorite part, from my semi-professional, scouting is how easy his delivery looks, which just makes it more funny that he's not Orioles bullpen or Orioles rotation material, because he just flicks it.
And it's 97.
It's so hard for all the other pitchers. For him, he can just, okay, yeah, we'll just go ahead and toss this over. Hit the black on 97. It's great. It was a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, I it was very enjoyable. The matchup against DeGrom was really fun. DeGrom looked utterly unhittable for like 4 1/3 innings and then got tired, and was still incredible. 11 strikeouts. I mean, that is, I think Sam Miller tweeted this, but like, this is like one of the, I forget exactly how he phrased it, but like just the most excitement, like heading into a start, like this was like top 20 between it being like Grayson Rodriguez and like for Jacob DeGrom, for it to happen at home, like at home for him. I don't know. It's a very, very fun, I mean, it's weird, but kind of fun confluence of events, in terms of like when you want to tune in for a guy's first start.
I guess the inherent problem was just it was still the 2023 Orioles against the 2023 Rangers, but yes.
Yeah, that is a bit of a downer, a little bit.
One of those teams won is the crazy thing.
Yeah. All right. I think that'll do it for that topic. Let's go take a quick break and we'll be back with our last two. Welcome back to episode 275 of Five and Dive. Before we get into our fourth topic, Patrick, I have a little bit of breaking news.
Okay.
We're having a second little banter here. Front Office Sports is reporting that Major League Baseball is ready to sell sponsorships for its new pitch clock to generate $10 million or more. How excited are we?
I mean,
so is it going to be the same pitch clock branding for every team then, I assume?
I did not read the article, I'm going to be honest. It was just the tweet. MLB's 30 teams could possibly... Okay, well, this is not a sentence. I'm going to read it as it's written. MLB's 30 teams could possibly local pitch clock sponsorship for millions of dollars apiece. So I'm it's local is what I'm...
Okay.
Well, yeah, I'm obviously against this, as I'm on the record saying that the clock should, you know, I understand that baseball wants to I understand that Manfred and the league want to get all the credit they can for fixing baseball forever. I still believe that we should draw as little attention to the clock itself as possible, while still enjoying its benefits, and this is not going to do that, so it sucks.
So I'll note, I agree. I will note, I've often made the comparison to tennis and the serve clock, which I appreciate very much. They never show it. You barely see it. It is not sponsored, but tennis does sponsor. They have just like a time of match clock that is always, it's like Tag Heuer or Hublot or whatever. I believe, Jeffrey, in soccer, European soccer, it's often Hublot. Anything does the
it's like the stop, the stoppage
Rolex time, maybe
usually, the stoppage time is usually sponsored as well.
So I feel like there's a way to do get something without it being specifically the pitch clock. You're gonna get trenchant insights into this article from some sports marketing analyst who said I would think any time related company would jump on it.
Fossil.
Fossil is perfect for the for baseball's audience.
Yeah.
Somebody makes sundials.
You know, the millennials are supposedly buying watches again, right? That's like a thing that was, maybe it's a few years old now, but.
Yeah, I don't remember. I mean,
unless swatches are coming back, I'm not interested.
I almost said swatch, so I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah, I don't know, just something to keep an eye on. It was inevitable. I mean, like, this was obviously they were going to try and sell something out of this. All right, our fourth topic today.
I wanted to just break in and please say one thing. Just to be a serious old man for a second. I think what I hate most about this, as with all sponsorships, as with state, you know, naming stadiums and everything else, is the reminder that everything can be sponsored, mm-hmm. and that everything is inherently worth something to a marketer. And it's just that most of the things that are not sponsored, they have a value, but it's just too small to be worth marketing.
Well, it's all a transaction of how can we make this worse for you. At a cost of how, like, that you will still tolerate it.
Yeah, how can we extract X number of dollars out of this situation?
It's like the MLB debut patches that they're going to chop up for, like, Topps game used cards or whatever.
Oh, yeah. We didn't even talk about that. Yeah. So, first of all, I think a debut patch is not the worst idea.
It's nice for the player. It's kind of cool. The player doesn't get to keep any of that shit.
Right, exactly. You can get to keep it. Like, that's such a cool...
You got to scrapbook your own shit.
I think all sports should do that. Someone's making their, like, official... Like, if it's international, like, the first international cap or whatever in soccer, like, give them a little patch. No, that's cool.
Some doofus is going to do a pack break on Twitch or whatever and get the Jordan Walker... a fragment of the Jordan Walker debut patch, like, 1 of 25 or however small they cut them off.
And you know what? Like, fine. I generally don't care, but, like, I do think that's a cool... Like, I don't know. Like,
the idea is cool.
As long as you don't then immediately go do it just to sell
Convert it into money, which is exactly what they're going
to
do.
Exactly.
I think they should have leaned in, and instead of the patch, they should have actually used the little gold bowl that Topps used to put on their rookie cards.
Yes. That the rated rookie or whatever. Yeah.
The rated rookie is Donruss. The gold bowl was Topps. Mm. Like
the rookie all star thing.
Yeah.
First Bowman jersey. I was going to say the Mets just announced they're doing New York Presbyterian patches as an ad for their. So I'm glad that the healthcare system is so flush with money in this country that they can get a patch on the Mets jersey. I mean, it is an appropriate sponsorship, to be fair, given that, like, Omar Narvaez is not going to miss 2 months. So
is he really?
Yeah, they just announced that today.
Welcome, Francisco Alvarez. So, okay, we will head to our fourth topic.
Speaking of teams that did not want to call up their top prospect.
Wait for this to get a sponsor, by the way. Uh-huh. Weights and measures is our fourth topic. We're talking the baseball again, guys. What's up with the ball?
I don't know. What is up with the ball? I mean...
Well, so I will tell you, I have to plead some ignorance on some of this. I did not realize MLB was publishing a drag dashboard these days based on a method to measure this by Alan Nathan. And we will have, I asked Rob Arthur to look into the state of drag and spin since MLB is supposedly cracking down harder on sticky stuff checks and things like that. But I had not realized MLB published it themselves on Savant. I feel like they don't really make it. I feel like they feel compelled to do it and also not compelled so much to advertise that they're doing it. Were you aware that they did this, Patrick?
I was not.
Yeah, I don't know. So, but they do. And drag is down. It's early days. We don't, you know, it's not a full data set or answer. I did see some preliminary stuff from Rob where he incorporated some spring training data as well, because they're able to track that in some spring training. It's definitely down. It's looking on what's on the dashboard at Savant is looking kind of 2018-ish.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that until 2022, there is a natural shape to the curves for each year, so that drag actually drops as the summer begins and then rises at the end of the year. So it's down and it will be down more once we hit June or July and the weather warms up.
Yeah, although we should note that like the 2017, so 2017, the second half is when the first version of the rocket ball showed up, right? Like that was when offense and home runs started exploding.
And but it was down that. Even before. Like from 2016 to 2017, it had already dropped.
Yes. Yeah. So, I agree. I'm just saying that's like when people tend to, because it was up so high at the end of 2016, I think people note in 2017, it really was like June and the second half, things started taking off. But you're right. There is kind of not quite a U shape, but there is a natural trend there. 2022, ironically, I guess, is maybe the most consistent it's been.
Yeah.
Year to year.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, at least
there are outliers, but it's on average, I guess, the most consistent.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to look at. It looks like the standard deviation is actually higher in 2022. And mm-hmm.
But right. But the trend line is
right. The trend line's flat. I should say. And of course, you know, the interesting thing is it flat everywhere? Is it flat in New York? it's a deeply unserious sport, and I hate that they're doing this again. You know, I wrote about this for one of the annuals a couple of years ago, but this sucks. It sucks that we can't trust what a baseball is, and it sucks that we can't look at players and look at different years to say, okay, these players were playing on the same field, because that's kind of what like half the point of baseball is that we believe that you can translate the stuff.
Yeah, and I will note again on like Rob's early data, it kind of looks closer to 2021 than 2018. I am also interested in you know, we've done some looks at, Dan Epstein wrote this week about the you know, whether the shift ban is making an impact, and I think there's some compelling reason to believe that it is in certain instances, but I think like the offensive changes across the game in terms of the run environment, like probably more impacted by the ball or the less drag on the ball than anything else. I mean, the bigger thing to me is like, I don't know. I guess it probably
like I guess the Patrick's point too is just like, obviously there's the arc of history in baseball, right? It's difficult to compare. I guess unless you're Keith Olbermann, it's difficult to compare Shohei Ohtani to like players from the 1920s. With the ball stuff, it's like you can't compare them to Logan Morrison now.
Right. And this is what baseball had over other sports. Like
so let me ask you this, Patrick. I said this to Jeff on the playback, but was it vacillating this extensively in the past and we just never we weren't measuring it? I mean, 2014's run environment was atrocious.
Right.
Was the ball just drag heavy that year?
Maybe.
Don't know.
Probably.
But I look at this stuff and I have to think probably.
We don't. I don't feel like we've had. I mean, we had, you know, 1968, right? We have 1987 was the year where suddenly Del Sveum was hitting 27 home runs. You have these little pockets, and I'm sure that there are variations that led into these. It doesn't feel like we have had this much variance year to year in other eras. It doesn't jump up and down. Like, we don't have Like after 68, they obviously, you know, fixed the mount and we put a stop to that. And but it was trending that way for a while. It was not just like 1968 suddenly happened. We had different baseballs. It was the entire 60s. We're going downhill as far as offensive forces. It feels anecdotally like the baseball is less trustworthy than it was in the past. Which is funny because you would think, you know, with the miracles of modern technology, we'd be getting better at making baseballs. We would have less of this kind of issue than in the past when a baseball was just like, you know, the skin of a horse wrapped around like somebody just making a ball of yarn around a rock. But no, it seems like, I think that's why there's so much frustration, is because it feels like something we should have more control over, and it feels like baseball has less control over it now.
So I'm just, this is a very rudimentary way to look at it, but I pulled up BRF's runs per game, right, by year. You go back to the dawn of the millennium, right? So 98, 99, 2000. 97 was 4.77, 98 was 4.79, 99 was 5.08. That's a massive change. That's bigger than year to year than anything we've had in the last few years.
Sure.
In like since we're tracking this stuff. So that was up to 5.08.
We had something else to blame.
Okay. That time but too. 5.14 2000, then it's 4.78 2001. That's a huge shift. Stayed around 4.7, 4.6, low 4.8, dropped to 4.59 in 2005. Then, you know, you go up to 2009, it's 4.61, 2010, 4.38, 2011, 4.28, 2012, 4.3, 2013, 4.17, 2014, 4.07. If you ask me what I think at this point is the major culprit for shifts like that, I have to think it's the ball. I don't what else is causing it to change that dramatically in a year to two. I have to think the drag on the ball changed and guys who were hitting it out weren't anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we can't know at this point. We certainly, the narrative around at the time was that steroids were causing all of that, right? I think the
you're saying might, early on, I yeah, but I then, even then in like the 2010 to 2014 yeah. range, it went from again like 4.6 in 2009 down to 4.07 in 2014.
Yeah,
I don't know. There was an expansion in that time. There was, you know, like I don't know how to explain that otherwise. I don't know. I wonder how much of it is based on what we're able to measure now. And I don't think that's a bad thing, to be clear. I'm glad we're able to look at this and care about this. But what I said to Jeffrey too was like, why I don't think the league is messy. It wouldn't surprise me if they're trying to change it. I don't think they can control the changes the way that they want to, number one. And number two, I don't think they're like doing it necessarily nefariously. I just don't understand how they're not able to do it better at this point.
Yeah, and I think part of our part for the conspiracy theorists, I think it's just that they have to be able to, right? They just can't believe that they are bad at it. And if they are good at it, if they can't control it, then they're choosing to do this. It's either that they're evil or inept, right?
Right.
And you can make the case for either side.
You can, and I'm not, I don't want to say, like, I mean, look, there's plenty of nefariousness in MLB, so I'm not trying to say, like, that's not the case or anything like that. I guess I just don't understand how this benefits them.
Well, I mean, it ties us full circle to the beginning of the podcast, right? I don't know. I don't understand either. I could see the argument that they were like, okay, well, we need, you know, we're making all these changes to bring up offense. You know, we want the game to be more exciting right now to coincide with these rule changes. We're not going to fix the actual problem, which is the pitchers throw 108. So we'll do all these other things instead. I also, you know, you can easily say, well, oh,
okay, but let's
they're well, bubbly Clouseau types that can't handle how to make a baseball.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Look, if you wanted to construct the narrative that like they're trying to improve offense with these changes, and this will superficially do it while masking whether the changes actually helped. Okay, Sure. I think that's a narrative you can certainly spin or sell. I think the part about guys throwing 108, I mean, like, what are you going to do about it? That's, you know, Russell kind of wrote about this a little bit, maybe not this specifically, but the idea that, like, you know, MLB found some, you know, front offices and whatever, they found some dead ends to this game. I think you're actually a good person to talk to. I've kind of tried to talk around this a couple times, but like I don't know the right term to talk about it in terms of board game or video games, but like there's like a meta aspect to it, right? There's like a game style play. There are strategies and ways to solve games.
Right.
And there are usually trade-offs, but people coalesce around certain ways and approaches that are best suited for specific games. I think front offices have to some degree done that. Right. Like that's a little bit what Russell was talking about when he said, like, we found some dead ends that you can't necessarily fix without changing the rules. That's what the league is doing. I actually don't have a huge problem with that because I think he's right.
Yes. They are the ones that make the rules. And that is where I have my frustration is the throwing up the hands and saying, well, nothing can be done. You're literally the people who can do it. It's very much like when politicians pretend like they have no power to solve problems when that's their job. It's to me, yes. I mean, we have dead ends. You have things you can, sports are made out of constraints. Like all games are made out of constraints. And you can't just say I win and walk away from the table. You have to follow the rules. And so you create the rules to make interesting constraints. If you don't want people throwing 108, create disincentives to make people throw max effort. And we've talked about the pat in the past. We've written an article about the restrictor plate and how to disincentivize pitchers going max effort, either by having fewer of them so that they can't afford to, or, you know, I think
they are doing, you know, they did finally get the 13 pitcher roster cap. I think 13 is probably too many, but it seems like that's not necessarily off the table to drop in the future.
Yeah. And I think that is, I think a lot of these other things, the shift ban, I think Russell is correct in that it is treating a symptom and not even a symptom that like caused other problems, but was totally the reaction to other problems, like with the hitters swinging from their heels. But, you know, yes, they should drop the max from 13 to 12, right? We should not let pitchers basically, we can't make a class of optionable pitchers into an extra bullpen arm.
Right.
Like these are things that teams do that they don't have to let themselves do.
Yeah.
And this is true. You know, this is another situation where you've got this problem with contracting the minor leagues. And one of the arguments for talking about contracting the minor leagues is that the teams that are good at producing minor league talent have too many of them. And so the idea is that you need to keep them from having enough players to hoard all the talent. That's what literally the Rule 5 draft is for. Right. And there are other solutions.
That's why there are probably like seven Dodgers playing for other teams from this year's Rule 5 draft or whatever it
is. Which they gutted the Rule 5 draft.
Yeah, they gutted the Rule 5 draft. And this is the thing, is that you could easily solve those problems with money by just saying, okay, well, players are free agents sooner, and so they can't hoard all these controllable, you know, players. But they don't want to do that, right?
Right. Well, we're seeing that. I mean, Jarrett wrote this week about the desire to cut down the domestic reserve list, right? Which is literally... I had someone offer the theory that just teams that are bad at development are mad that teams that are good. I mean, literally what you're saying, Patrick, that teams that are bad at development are mad that the good development teams are developing talent and keeping it in their system. And rather than try and get good at it themselves, they said, no, we're just want to take it away from you.
And the people who live in mid-sized towns. So for me, I personally am very unsympathetic towards teams that say there's nothing that can be done. And so I'm pro rule change. I don't love the shift ban. I don't also care that much, and I'll probably stop thinking about it pretty soon. But there are other fixes that can be done, and we should, like, the goal to get rid of these dead ends is the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to me. You look at other sports the NBA has gone like back and forth on whether zone defense is acceptable, whether, you know, they change rules constantly. Like the NFL has changed how, you know, whether defenders can jam up the wide receivers at the line of scrimmage and things like that. Like all sports make changes. I don't know that all the changes that MLB is pursuing are the best, but I don't know that it's wrong to try and, again, like adjust for kind of the solves that we had. I, you know, philosophically, I don't like the shift ban, but I don't know that I have a problem with the outcome. And I do think it's going to change a little bit of how teams approach this kind of stuff. So we got a little bit away from weights and measures, but I do think the ball is tied up in all of that, because I also think the ball being able to fly is supporting offense to some degree. Now, I think they hope that the rule changes around the shift ban and things like that are going to bring back a different style of play. We have seen stolen bases go up a lot, things like that. But home runs have really been supporting, you know, they've been the foundation of runs per game offense for the last few years here. And we've seen when drag goes up, home runs go down and runs per game go down. So I think, you know, it is all kind of tied together on that front. But I think that can suffice. We can put that on ice for now. I'm sure we'll return to it throughout the year. Patrick, we have a fifth segment that I can see in the doc. I have not scrolled down because I know you're doing some stuff in here, but it is labeled Dumb Little Game.
Yeah. Enjoy this. And you're going to hate this, but okay. I do appreciate that we managed to talk about this a little bit earlier in talking about the MLB debut and the Topps Gold Cup, which I love. So, you know, with the new season, there is a new series of baseball.
Am I allowed to scroll down and see this?
Oh, yeah. I haven't put anything on the dock. I just put a couple examples of some baseball cards. So 2023, Topps has a new set, one of its last. Although apparently Topps will live on as being a brand name for Fanatics, who has bought them out. So we will still
Fanatics
have Topps
who is just straight up horrible.
Yeah.
On every level.
But they now own Topps, so there will still be Topps cards. It's just that different rich people will make more money when you buy them. But so every year, Topps has, for the past, I don't know how long, because I don't really collect modern baseball cards that much, they make a subset where they pull out cards from a previous year and basically use the old design, because old baseball cards look better than new baseball cards. And they do a 35th anniversary, which I think is very funny, because nothing says a specific important date like 35th anniversary. They don't do the 25th anniversary because cards from 25 years ago look kind of bad. I just put a picture that nobody else can see of the 1998 top set, which is a gold bordered card with the player's name and foil at the bottom. It doesn't look good, and nobody wants to see more of these. But the iconic 1988 top set is being reproduced this year, so you can get your favorite stars like Julio Rodriguez with a 1988 Topps border. And so because of this, I was thinking about 1988 Topps and celebrating it, which was one of kind of the most disliked sets of my childhood. The 1988 top set was not held in high regard, mostly because at that point, Topps was kind of falling behind the curve on other teams or other card companies. They weren't including as many of the rookies that everybody was excited about. They didn't really have any insert cards or subsets. So what I wanted to do, I pulled out a 1988 May issue of the Beckett Baseball Card Magazine. And I wanted you to guess who the six biggest rookies were in 1988 as far as baseball card value.
God.
And I will give you, it's impossible for you. I'm going to give you 2 minutes. So this
am
is
I
basically,
supposed to, do I get to look at who the rookies were?
You can look at the rookies. I probably should have pasted in some sort of
this is the 1988 set. So this is the 1987 season.
So the 1987 season had taken place. If we want to, I can pull it up here real quick.
I'll put the link in the chat. I do want to
note, it took me a little bit, but I have found the 35th anniversary the 35th anniversary, like, traditional gift and like theme, you know, what you're supposed to give.
Is it cardboard?
I was curious. Well, I was curious what, like, why 35, right? I was curious, like, was there some reason? It is coral. The traditional gift is coral. The modern or contemporary gift is jade.
I'm surprised it's not just diamond, because I feel like they just do diamond like six times now.
The 35th anniversary gemstone is emerald, in fact. Yeah. So, let everyone.
Yeah, modern jewelers really up the value of those those gifts. They, yeah, you gotta buy diamonds.
Oh God!
All right. So this is when these cards were coming out. So the cards would have been released in April. In May, the next month, which players were the most valuable rookie cards to own?
Can I throw some guesses out?
Yeah, please.
I'm going to start with Kevin Seitzer.
Kevin Seitzer is not only correct, he is the second most valuable.
Second, okay.
Yeah, number two. People were big on Kevin Seitzer.
He had a huge rookie season.
He did have a huge rookie season.
Then did nothing else, really. I mean, he had a fine career.
Okay.
He made two All-Star games. This collection, these six players combined to go to 10 All-Star games.
Okay.
And combined for 156 baseball reference war. Seitzer was third on that list as far as war goes.
David Cone?
David Cone is incorrect. He had a rookie card in 1987, but also he does not come close.
Most
of these cards
were
worth at least $1 in 1988.
I'm going to go with BJ Surhoff.
Surhoff had rookie cards in 87 as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the trick with this is that a lot of players had their rookie cards beforehand.
Yeah.
I don't know. He probably had it. No, he definitely had 87. So that's not going to work. Boy, this is. This is tough. I'm running into a lot of guys that would have had it a year before.
Yeah, you might want to look into 88 as well, just to see who got their cup of coffee and got a rookie card.
It's surprising to me that Seitzer came up in 86.
Yeah, he didn't. Yeah, but he did. He just didn't get a rookie card in 87. I don't think.
Well, so I don't know. Like,
how about
Mark McLemore?
Mark McLemore was not. In that list.
Well, he was not good, but no. You know, he hung around forever. So,
but in 1988, they would not have known that.
Well,
I will tell you, Tom Glavine. I know that. Tom Glavine also not on this list, despite being like one of the, I think the only Hall of Famer from this rookie card group.
How about Ron Gant?
Ron Gant, close. Oh, I do like, but Ron not. Gant. He did not make it at the time. I think there was a point later on where his rookie card was worth a dollar, but not at this point.
Was one of them an MLB manager at any point?
I don't think so.
Okay, I'm going to retract mine. Boy, he was horrible early, so not him. Ellis Burks.
Ellis Burks is correct.
I thought about Ellis Burks. Yeah.
He is both. I'm on the board. Is the number one. As far as career value.
All right.
He was worth $1.25 at the time. I will give you a hint. We have another Red Sox on this list as well.
I was going to guess Mike Greenwell.
Greenwell does not count. He had 87 rookie card.
Patrick, this is.
All right. I'm giving you, I'm cutting you off.
That's fine.
Yeah.
All right. So our other four rookies. Mark Grace, $1.25.
Okay.
Yep. Matt Noakes, also $1.25.
Wow.
One-time All-Star for the Detroit Tigers. You got Sam Horn.
Okay.
With his career 2.3 WAR, he was worth $1.25. And the king of the 1988 rookie cards, Greg Jeffries. He of the
19. I should have gotten that. I see, but he was up in 86, so I assumed he had an 87 one. But
no, he didn't. He didn't even get all of, he only had a couple of 88 cards. Only Donerson, Fleer, and Score made rookie cards for him. Tops did not. And so one of the reasons why the 88 Tops.
I had the Greg Jeffries future stars one as a
I don't get to play that, like I was a year old for this shit anymore.
Yeah.
Like card anymore, but well, I was 89. Like a year old for this shit.
Okay.
I feel like as a service to people collecting from my age, because everything else is designed now that the boomers are on their way out in terms of purchasing power, somebody should make a 1988 Topps Greg Jeffries rookie card. I would buy one. Because that's the thing we all want as kids. We want a Greg Jeffries rookie cards.
Well, you know, retro is in these days, yeah. Patrick. So we have a shot. But since Fanatics will make it, it'll be really shitty, and you might.
I'm now looking at the 89 Jeffries, Greg Jeffries future stars. I think instead of the MLB debut patch, they should just have done the like drop shadow future star patch instead on the jersey.
I think rated rookie is good. Tremendous. I know it's not Tops, but like
it's also the right shape for a patch too. More
yeah, than they should just acquire. It's such a shame because it is a cool idea. They should do more little token honorific kind of stuff. Like that's.
If you're going full retro, what you should do is have those old Transformers logos where you had to the heat patch where you had to rub to show. Make it truly 80s.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else that we'd like to mention before we say goodbye?
I can't think of anything. Okay. I apparently am not going to this Mario movie today, so I've offered a reprieve. Scheduling difficulties.
My condolences.
I know. Now it looms in the future as some sort of unspoken threat.
They say anticipation is really the best part, Patrick. All right. Well, I'll just
make the kids watch the 1993 Super Mario movie instead.
Oh, there you go. I saw people waxing poetic about that recently, and I thought, you know, just because it's better than whatever is coming out doesn't mean we have to go too far, you know.
Yeah, you need to do a Bob Hoskins double feature with The Long Good Friday, and you're good to go.
All right.
Every practical effect that's ever been made is better than every digital effect. That's what we know about movies.
Yes,
that is that was the thrust of what I saw going on, and I don't think it's untrue. And at the same time, I think what I saw was someone saying like there are some like real like they didn't say it was like a cinematic masterpiece, but they said like. It's like real cinema. And I was like, okay, like it's Mario. Like, just calm down a little bit. I agree with your broader point, but chill out a little.
I can't. I'm not the person to talk about this because I am the dad who puts on Harold Lloyd's Safety Last, you know, the old silent black and white movie.
And, making huge models of the Mushroom Kingdom like it's Blade Runner. Yeah.
Okay. Here's what was stated. Genuinely and without any irony, the original Super Mario's Brother movie had moments of cinematic beauty. And I think that's where they used a real set. They used like it looks realer. I'm for all of that, right? But let's maybe back off of cinematic beauty.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think the original Mario Brothers movie is weird. It's not good, but it's weird in a way that movies often fail to be anymore. Because
I think I'm just going to tie this back to baseball. I think this is the wave of nostalgia for like the Devil Rays uniforms that we see now. I know Jeff's point of view is like it has a perspective, like it's doing something, and that's fine. But that perspective, in my opinion, is ugly. And I understand being tired of like the current Rays unis are boring and they just don't do anything. I think they're fine, but like they are boring. But like ugly is not better.
I think that there is an appeal to looking at a thing and thinking that no focus group has ever touched this thing.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. And I understand that appeal, but it's still, regardless, it's like not attractive.
Yeah,
it's like extremely ugly.
I mean, if nothing else, we know the Tampa Bay Rays are outsider art. So
anyway, we'll go make your kids watch Safety Last and constantly tell them as they're watching the movie, hey, that guy's actually on the side of the building. Like, right. Like he was on the building. He was.
We're a Buster Keaton family here.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That barn actually fell on Buster Keaton. Yeah.
All right. And well, thank you. Thank you both for your movie takes and for joining me as co-hosts of this episode of Five and Dive, brought to you by the Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network. You can get in touch with the show at fiveanddive@baseballprospectus.com. We are wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network, and we'll be in that feed. If you like what we're doing, please drop us a rating and a review. Thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you early next week.